to Troubleshooting Agile. Hi there, Jeffrey.
Hi, Squirrel.
So I think we have story time with Jeffrey today because you were telling me you had two related stories, which both sounded really interesting, the first of which happened like 80 years ago.
Yeah.
So must not be one you were involved in, but tell us, what's the first story?
Sure. It predates me quite a bit, and it has to do, I've started reading a book that I had been recommended to me, I think originally by Gene Kim of IT Revolution. He had talked about this book, Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway. And for people who don't know, Midway was a decisive turning point in the World War II battle in the Pacific, because it's the time where the Japanese Imperial Navy lost what had up to then been their huge strategic advantage, which is they had more aircraft carriers than anyone else. So, but that's this battle turned things around. And so I was reading this, and something, a story came up in there that I thought would be really interesting to talk about on the podcast because of how it might relate to situations that our listeners might find themselves in.
Okay, so the stories are going to have something to do with software, although this one sure doesn't seem like it does yet.
Yes.
So keep going. What happened before the Battle of Midway that was that has lessons for us in software?
Well, the many things happened, and many lessons we've drawn, but the one I wanted to focus on was perhaps the most surprising to me, anyway, at least so far in the book, and that is before the battle, the Japanese Imperial Navy, the fleet that was going to be carrying out this attack on the Midway Atoll, which is somewhere to the west of Hawaii, it's as you might hear, it's a midway point. They had a war game, and war games are something that you do very commonly to find out things that might go wrong. You're trying to learn lessons. You're stress testing your battle plan, and you want to make sure you find any holes in it. And they had
this reminds me of software things we do, like penetration tests, where we have some hackers on a red team go and try to break into our system. But they're our hackers. They're good people, and they tell us when they break in. Yeah, or pre-mortems. You know, we try to think of what's going to happen on Black Friday when lots of people come to our website. But we do that a few weeks before Black Friday so we can actually get new servers in place. Have I got the right idea?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then we do all kinds of things to try to generate information. And really, the goals are trying to falsify our hypothesis. And I think that's the key thing here. You know, scientific learning is about not confirming what you believe, but rather falsifying it. And this could be, you know, customer interviews. It could be all kinds of things that would happen. And you're right. We do lots of different practices in that way. And this is what interests me in this story, because here they are doing this information generating exercise in theory, but it has to be done with the right spirit or it doesn't work. And the fact that they weren't doing it in the right spirit became clear as they're reading the book, when it turned out that the red team, which is some junior officers playing the Americans, they didn't follow the script that the plan had been based on, and they decided to act differently than expected and be much more aggressive about coming into the battle, and had this surprising result where in the war game they sunk two of the Japanese carriers. And what happened is the table judge, the person who's refereeing, looked at that result and said, well, that kind of result is impossible. They basically discounted it and made them essentially do over. They undid what the red team had said they were going to do and forbade them. They undid the damage, rolled back the clock, said, nope, those you know, Japanese carriers didn't sink. Now go attack the right way, you know, that we're set up to. And then they proceeded from that point. And so they lost the opportunity to learn which was the entire point of the war game. So,
and the assumption they were making, if I understand it right, is that the Americans were not going to get to Midway that quickly, that they had to recover more after Pearl Harbor, they didn't have the resources, they were demoralized, that they made that assumption. And when the red team broke that assumption and said, hey, you've got a rule here which we're not going to follow, the judge, you know, they do this all on a table with little carvings of the ships. It's not the real ships, of course. And the judge put the ships back on the table and said, no, you don't get to actually violate the rules in this way. And then what happened in the actual battle?
Yeah, and it turned out what the Americans did was they aggressively left Pearl Harbor and established themselves in pretty much the same position that the Red Team had done, with the result that came out in the war game. Now, there's a lot of other things that play into it, but it was really surprising that this war game, in fact, that was designed to generate contingency plans. And point out weaknesses, that the information that came out of it was completely disregarded.
But in one sense, they actually did the war game correctly because they had set up rules and they said, this is what we want to model. And if the Red Team had said, yes, and we're going to get our alien allies from Mars and they're going to fly their spaceships down and attack Midway, that would have been outside the rules too. That would have been another way of violating the rules. And that would have been correct to undo. What the problem was that they set up the rules incorrectly. And so when they set up the rules, they were not creative enough. They didn't have enough willingness to accept out of the norm thinking, if I got that right.
No, actually, not quite right. It's the difference between rules and assumptions. So there's the assumptions of the plan, and there's the rules of the war game. There was nothing by the rules of the war game that forbade the Red Team from acting the way they did. It hadn't matched the prior assumptions by which the plan had been made. There was never a constraint placed on them until they came up
I
with that
see.
solution.
So there were implicit
And
rules. It would be as if, oh, you know, there's a wonderful video which I will dig up and I'll put it in the show notes if I can find it. I think I can. But it's a wonderful story about a Red Team, an actual hacking team that had permission to hack a bank, and they were trying all different ways to hack the bank. And somebody who was very clever figured out on the team that the rules, the bank actually had said, you can attack us in any way you want. And they said, you know, one of the things we could do is we could go rob the bank down the street. And they actually walked into the bank. They weren't wearing masks or anything. They didn't have guns. But they walked in and they checked the security of the bank by actually robbing it. And then, of course, announcing to everyone who showed up that they were part of the Red Team. But this was absolutely not something that the bank expected. So I will put this video in the show notes if I can find it, because it's a hilarious story. That's an example where the bank had probably not assumed that their software hacking Red Team would show up at a bank branch. But in fact, I assume, I hope, that the bank learned a lot of things about how they were physically insecure from these folks showing up and pointing out various kinds of problems with the physical security and the software that informed it in the actual physical bank. So I think that might be a closer example.
And I love that example, and it really points out this is the point of the wargaming, which is that it's there to challenge the assumptions that we make, because as we make plans, we make certain assumptions, and you get some of the Red Team mentality. And the point is, the Red Team are your friends. They're there to think creatively and come up with things that you may not have considered. I mean, I had thought you were going to talk about a different Red Team thing with the bank, which is where the software security testers put USB dropped USB keys in the parking lot of the bank.
Oh, right. That's another
and
good one.
and also I've heard of versions where people have done the same thing in a washroom. They'll go into the bank, this is not a bank branch, but rather a bank, that they'll use the restroom in the lobby and leave a USB stick behind. And of course, some employee picks it up, is curious, puts it in their computer to look to see what's on it, and has software infect their system, and now behind the firewall. That kind of creativity of attack is the purpose of a red game. And what stood out to here was, and I come back here, like, why did this stand out to me? Which was, we do these things to test our assumptions, but sometimes when they don't match the assumptions we made, we reject them. And that's what happened in this war game. Not both here, and then later on, there was a place where the land-based defenders on Midway, the aircraft there, sunk two of the ships, according to the dice roll. And again, the table job undid the dice roll and said, "Oh no, only one of them sank." And then later, worse, when they continued the war game as the campaign, that sunk carrier magically came back to be used. So they were completely, violating the spirit of the war game and allowing this kind of scripted operation to unfold. And the whole thing was done in the spirit of a checkbox exercise.
We're going through the motions here, but we aren't actually learning anything, because when we find anything that we don't expect, we discount it. And I bet some of our listeners will be thinking, gosh, that kind of sounds like my organization. Nobody seems to learn anything around here. And Jeffrey, I think your second story might reinforce that. Then I have something to challenge there. So your second story is directly about software, I think. Also pretty old, but not quite that old.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it had me thinking, and I'll say that I'll make a bit of a bridge here, of what are the other times I've experienced where people have not taken on board the learning that was there to be learned. And there are many minor cases of it. I can think of examples where we've done client interviews and the clients didn't show the enthusiasm for the features we were building that we were hoping for. And people found ways to say, these were probably the wrong kinds of clients. We think the real clients will really love it.
Once they see it, they'll really like it. They just didn't understand it.
That's right.
We need more wizards so that they can understand it when they get it.
That's right. Or testers who test softwares in ways that break it, and the response is, but our clients won't actually do that. Various things like that. But what really came back to me was something very early in my career, and that was back when I was at Borland, back in close to its heyday. I joined Borland in 1992, and I was in the languages group. And at the time, Borland C++ 3.1 had recently been released, and it was the dominant C++ IDE on Windows and DOS. It had something like 70%.
Not all our listeners will know what all those things mean. C++ is a language. IDE is a method of creating code in that language. Borland was a software company that made one of these compilers and environments in which you would put the software together. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the main thing here is we had this dominant market share of 70-80% market share, which was fantastic. Now, the thing that happened that was a bit shocking is that if you came back, 2 years later, the numbers were reversed. So whereas at the time Borland had 70-80% market share, Microsoft had something like 20-30% market share. In 2 years, Microsoft had 70-80% market share, and Borland was down to 20-30%. And what happened? This is a dramatic reversal of fortunes, much like the Battle of Midway, which is maybe why I was thinking of the two things. And it really goes back to the idea of Borland had seen the competition in one way, which was that this was a competition between C++ products, and what mattered was the strength of the compiler, and the strength of the compiler was how well it implemented the C++ specification. And that's what good meant, and that's therefore the plan of battle between Borland and Microsoft would be fought on how good someone's C++ compiler was in implementing the spec. And what Microsoft
those are the
is
rules.
They...
That's what we assume the other people are going to do. That's the obvious thing to do. And the thing I want to challenge our listeners on is often software developers have a very narrow view of what better is. And I often don't let my clients say that something is better or something is the best practice. I call it betterism, because take some particular very narrow view of what it constitutes better. And here, Borland in the story is saying better means we support more of the specification. We do more stuff. Our compiler is a better compiler that puts the software together in a better way. Now, what actually happened?
Well, and so, yes, and this is the point, is that Borland, of course, assumed that Microsoft would buy into the same mindset and they would try to compete by trying to catch up with Borland's compiler. But Microsoft did something very sneaky, which is they went and talked to the clients who were using C++ compilers on Windows and asked them what they were doing and what they cared about. And it turned out while they were using C++ compilers, they were using it to compile C code. They were using it as a better C compiler, and they didn't really care about the advanced C++ features because they weren't really writing C++. What they really cared about was, can you give me more sample code? Can you make my job easier by giving me more code I can copy and paste? And so when Microsoft came out with Visual C++ 1.0, which was another bit of marketing, they had been very successful with Visual Basic, so rebranded their compiler as Visual C++, even though it was very little visual about it. One of the main things they did was bring out much more sample code, and they changed the type of competition from who has the better C++ compiler to who has more examples of using the Windows API in C, and which is what their clients actually cared about. And that led to this very dramatic reversal of fortunes. So it was that those lessons there, those clients there, Borland could have talked to them, but I don't think there was a message that they could have heard, because they had this fixed idea in their head of how the competition was going to unfold. And they, I don't think, were very open to alternatives to the story they have in their head. And I think that's the kind of lesson here, is about how can we be open to learning that our story of the world isn't the right one.
And if I remember right, Jeffrey, you were involved in talking to some of those customers. This was early in your career, and were you doing support or customer service, or so you were doing something that involved talking to them? And I bet you never asked them what they were thinking about C++.
Well, actually, I was in support, and you're right, and I was in support for the languages group, and so I did talk to the clients coming in, and I was often answering the questions they had, and sometimes they were about esoteric C++ features, but an awful lot of them were much more basic, you know, and so I did talk to some of them, and I even got moved in, so I was a liaison from support into the Borland C++ 4.0 efforts, which are the ones that launched in 1993 at the same time that Microsoft came out with Visual C++. And so I did have a lot of insight into the development environment and the development team's mental model of the fight. So I do know that they were a very compiler-centric group, and were not actively involved in soliciting. At least the ones I had exposure to weren't actively involved in trying to falsify their idea of what good meant to the customers.
Excellent. So, or rather not excellent. It sounds like that was rather catastrophic for the company, but an excellent example of exactly the sort of thing that I want to challenge our listeners to do. They may say, well, look, my company just functions this way. We listen to the highest paid person. We build the features that somebody wants. When we get feedback that what we're doing isn't actually useful, we don't pay attention. The developers don't listen to me over here in marketing or in support when I hear what customers want. So it's hopeless for us. And the thing I'd encourage listeners to do, no matter what level they're at and no matter what their situation is to begin talking, using the language of hypotheses and falsification. One of my favorite messages, that it's kind of a sneaky, smuggled-in message that can really shift how an organization thinks. And that message is that we've had an experiment here. We ran an experiment, and we got a negative result, and that was a success. If you can just start changing the way that people talk about the experiments they're doing, the things that they're trying, the features that they're building, you will see a dramatic change in mindset. And it doesn't have to be everyone. It doesn't have to come from the top. It's something that you could start doing today. So that's my challenge to you all, is go forth and don't get your carriers blown up. Instead, falsify your hypotheses. Celebrate getting a negative result from your experiment. That's a success. What do you think, Jeffrey?
I love it. Emphasis on learning. How do we falsify? That's I completely agree. These are the kind of memes that I try to introduce to people I work with as well. So love to hear it and see if people are successful in that, or if they have challenges in that. I would love to hear some more of our listeners' stories in this area.
Well, we of course always love listening to our listeners and hearing from them. The best way that you can do that, of course, is to get in touch via agileconversations.com. There you'll find free videos and material from us and practice documents and, gosh, you know, dojo guides and loads of other things, and our book, Agile Conversations. We can hear from you if you get in touch with us via the email that's there, the Twitter handles. I'm on Instagram these days, although I don't know how to get messages from it. I'm sure I could figure it out. So use any method you like, a carrier pigeon if it's better, but we'd love to hear from you and respond to you, because those lead to our best episodes. And of course, the other thing you can do is keep in touch with us by coming back next Wednesday, when we'll have another edition of Troubleshooting Agile. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Carl.